Bienvenido.
Bienvenidos.
Magandang araw sa inyo.
Dobrый день.
Bienvenue.
Volcherov.
Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
Here on Earth.
Bienvenido a Here on Earth.
On his first official full day as Pope, Benedict XVI reached out to Muslims, saying he was grateful for their presence at his investiture ceremony and hoped for a growth of dialogue between Muslims and Christians. An important symbolic gesture, quelling fears that this arch-conservative enforcer of church orthodoxy and the successor to the Inquisition would shut down the dialogue initiated by his predecessor, Pope John Paul II. There was a time in Spain that lasted 700 years when Muslims, Christians, and Jews all lived together and flourished under Muslim rule. It was a golden age that ended just before Ferdinand and Isabella sent Columbus to the New World. But as Chris Lowney makes clear in his book, A Vanished World, Medieval Spain's Golden Age of Enlightenment, religious enmity eventually shredded this common society, leaving a fissure that still haunts the West. I'm Jean Ferraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, making people-to-people connections around the world, and, we might add, through history. In this hour, we look back at the West's first multi-religious society under Muslim rule and ask, what was it that made it possible for the three great religions of the world to work together and profit from rubbing elbows? What brought about the decline of this great civilization? And in a time of so much religious strife in our own era, can we afford not to learn from this story? What about our own society? Are we ourselves living in a vanishing world when the religious tolerance that has characterized our own multicultural society is yielding to a new form of Christian orthodoxy? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're listening online, send your messages to hereonearth@wpr.org. And that here is spelled H-E-R-E. Chris Lowry is a former Jesuit, and he holds degrees in medieval history and philosophy, and served as a managing director for J.P. Morgan & Company on three continents. He's written a history of the Jesuits, and his latest book is A Vanished World, Medieval Spain's Golden Age of Enlightenment. Chris Lowney, welcome to Here on Earth.
Thank you so much, Jean. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I know you have very personal reasons for writing this book, and I'd love you to tell our listeners about them.
Maybe I could tell the story that got me started on the book. I was on vacation in Spain in September of 2000, the same month as the horrible disaster in my home city of New York, in the Twin Towers. And one of the things I wanted to do was go across the medieval pilgrim route that runs across the north of Spain to a little town called Santiago de Compostela. And it's a beautiful trip. I'd recommend it to any listeners. It's moving, it's fun, and you can bike it, walk it, drive, in any case. By Christian tradition, the relics of St. James the Apostle are in this town, and so for centuries, Christians and others have been making that route, and you usually see St. James in statues as Santiago Peregrino, St. James the Pilgrim, which to me is a beautiful image because he's dressed like his devotees, you know, a normal person, and we all have our fears and anxieties, and the saint is one of us. And as you go along, you also occasionally see another image, which is of a saint with a big sword that he's about to swing down on some poor cowering turbaned guy cowering below, and that's Santiago Matamoros, or, as we would say, basically, St. James the Muslim Killer. Mm. And, you know, you can imagine how seeing that image would strike one, especially in that month of our human history.
You know,
from that time I began to think, you know, what do these medieval Muslims, Christians, and Jews have to say to us in the modern age.
And it's not just in Europe that this has played out. I'm just remembering there was a study of this done by the former executive of Wisconsin's Humanity Council, who studied plays, folklore in Latin America. That's all based on conflict between the Muros and the Cristianos.
Yes, yeah. That's a rich image. And in fact, I mean, there's still Matamoros, Mexico, still exists. A town in Mexico, and of course St. James. You know, we project our hopes and fears and our angers, I think, onto our religious icons. Yeah, and so St. James then also got enlisted in the colonial struggles across the Americas, and he became Santiago Mata Indios, St. James the Indian Killer.
And, oh, is that so?
Yeah, and there were also towns in Latin America called Mata Indios, which, of course, thankfully is. The Republican movement spread across those countries, that those names were changed to more fitting names.
Mm. So who were the Moors? 7-11 was when the Moors came to power in Spain with
that's
a
right.
battle.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, a story that like almost is a bit hard to believe in a way. There's an invasion force of between 5 and 10,000 who come from North Africa. Maybe they would have been led by smaller groups of Arab Muslims, but the majority would have been North Africans. And, you know, after a few skirmishes, they engaged the troops of the king, King Roderick, the last king of Visigoth Spain, and really dispatched him. Probably they were so outnumbered. When you think of this group of 10,000, they were probably a reconnoitering force in a country of maybe 4 or 5 million Christians. But I guess, you know, the last kings of Spain had really distinguished themselves only by their ineptitude, and so there was no great desire, perhaps, to rally behind them. And quite quickly, the invaders managed to take over more or less the vast majority of what's today Spain and Portugal.
And so they must have been very, very effective. And I bet they were effective because of a core belief that united them.
Yes, you know, for sure. I mean, of course, as we know, the prophet Muhammad, lives in the first half of the 7th century, the 600s. And, you know, with his death, the spread of Islam across the world is, I mean, it's just shocking. You know, look at a map sometimes, you know, these lands all the way to parts of India, what is today parts of India, part of China, to southern Spain. This all happens in, 70 or 80 years, a large part of it. And, of course, they were sort of steeled by their religious convictions. And perhaps one of the things that enabled them to have an accepted rule in Spain is that the Quran, as many of the listeners would know, has this concept of tolerance for so-called people of the book. In other words, Jews and Christians, those who have a revealed monotheistic scripture, should be entitled to tolerance, albeit the tolerance of second-class citizens, but tolerance. So their rule was, for the most part, especially in these early centuries, by the somewhat gruesome standards of medieval life, their rule was rather benign and enlightened.
You know, I happen to have been in Cordoba on 9/11 myself, which was the capital of this kingdom, had just walked out of the Great Mosque of Cordoba. There's a photograph of it in your book. And then had visited Maimonides' synagogue and learned about the crash of the second. Actually watched it on television in the gift shop that was right next to the synagogue. And my husband and I were both, of course, in deep shock. And as we left Cordoba, going right through a museum that was celebrating this golden age when Maimonides, the great Jewish theologian and philosopher, and Averroes.
Yes, Averroes, yeah, or Averroes, yeah.
The Muslim rationalist philosopher, theologian, and Christians were all in dialogue and learned from each other and enjoyed the muscularity of their, you know, interchanges. And all of this celebrated as we left Cordoba on our way to Granada, listening tearfully to the radio and getting just snatches of news from, you know, that told us that President Bush was circling the country in an airborne. And, you know, it was so confusing and strange. And as it turns out, it was almost prophetic to be in that place at that moment, knowing that as our world was falling apart and these terrible divisions and jihads and crusades would begin all over again, we were in the very place where people came together.
Yes, yeah. You know, and I totally agree with you. I mean, I have a similar feeling of that, of being in that place in Spain of all places, you know. And I think, one of the questions that I bring up in the book and invite readers and listeners now to think about a bit is, you know, what is history? Where are we going? And we tend to have a concept of we're going forward. You know, we progress. There's technological progress. And, of course, the three great monotheistic religions have an idea of history as a journey forward toward redemption in some way or another. But, you know, you're standing in medieval Spain, and, you know, you say, well, gee, I mean, are we going forward or are we going in circles? What are we doing? And of course, there were ancient civilizations that believed history was cyclical. You know, that we just ever were kind of chasing our tail. And you know, history goes in circles if we humans make it go in circles with these cycles of vengeance sought for and resentment always nurtured and acted out upon.
Well, we're talking about a time that spans 700 years. A lot can happen in that time. And this golden age that we speak of, when there was so much interchange and dialogue, I'm assuming that happened towards the end of this period. But what was it like for ordinary people living in little towns throughout Spain? Was there always resentment of Moorish rule?
Yeah, you know, I think we could say this for starters. You know, a religious minority would probably be happier living in most places in the United States today than in medieval Spain. You know, but having said that, you know, when we discount for the mindset that they would have had, in many ways they managed to make extraordinarily successful accommodations, you know. And we have stories of for example, in Muslim Spain, Christians would have served in government if they wanted, served in the armed forces. There would have been economic opportunity, and of course, to get ahead, just as people adapt today, these medieval folks would have adapted. So Christians and Jews would have learned Arabic and dressed in the way that those influenced by Arab civilization were dressing in order to kind of blend in with the successful culture. So all kinds of accommodation and adaptation and learning is going on.
We're talking with Chris Lowney. He is the author, most recently, of A Vanished World, Medieval Spain's Golden Age of Enlightenment. And we're talking about that story in the light of our own troubles, divisions, especially around religion. Can we afford to ignore this story? We're going to talk about how it came to flowering and, perhaps most importantly, how it dissolved. It was 1492 that brought Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand back into Christian dominance of Spain, and then they brought on the Inquisition, which drove the Jews out of Spain. I don't know what happened to the Muslims, but we'll find out after this break. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can join us by calling 1-800-642-1234 or by sending your comments, questions, and messages to hereonearth@wpr.org. I'm Jean Faraca.
For new ideas and fresh perspectives, keep it right here on the Ideas Network. We look for the very best guests to talk about issues you care about, and we welcome calls from listeners like you. From where we've been to where we're headed, you'll hear all about it on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio's Audience Services is ready to help you with any programming question you may have. Call toll-free 1-800-747-7444 when you want more information about anything you hear. 1-800-747-7444.
On the next Here on Earth, we'll follow the 4,000-year-old footsteps of Hajar, a single mother, the original pilgrim to Mecca and mother of the Islamic nation. Our guide will be Azra Nomani, single mother, former Wall Street Journal correspondent and author of Standing Alone in Mecca. She'll talk about her personal journey and the American struggle for the soul of Islam. That's coming up on the next Here on Earth. This hour, Chris Lowney is with us, and we're talking about the story of the West's first multi-religious society under Muslim rule in multicultural Spain. Chris, we were talking before the break about the flowering of this civilization and the way it was lived in little towns throughout Spain. But there must have been this ferment below the surface. I mean, you mentioned that it was the Moors who were in charge, and second-class citizenship was extended to non-Muslims, that is, to Jews and Christians living in Spain at this time. Eventually, it ended in the Battle of Granada that brought Ferdinand and Isabella, Catholic monarchs, into power and ended the 700-year period. What happened to Jews and Muslims under their rule? And what was the reconquest all about?
Yes. Well, I think we could, this vast sweep of history over 700 years, we could oversimplify and maybe divide into three big chunks. The first third or so of the time, the Muslim rule is pretty much blankets the whole Iberian Peninsula. And then, there starts some civil war among the Muslim princes, and, of course, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And these Christian kingdoms, which had been pushed way to the north, begin to slowly coalesce and reassert themselves. And that starts the time that is called the Reconquest. And, of course, it really is linked and is part of the Crusades. Remember, the Crusades begin in 1095 to the Holy Land, and it's really almost the same time that the Christian kingdoms begin making their concentrated pushes through the Iberian Peninsula. And then the last third of the time, Christian kingdoms are really dominant in the peninsula, and it's just this little area around Granada, this small pocket where Muslim rule still lasts. And, of course, that ends in 1492. And I don't know, maybe we'll move on, I'm sure, to the story of 1492 itself.
The Crusades began in 1095 when Muslim terrorists bombed the train station in Madrid. They claimed responsibility for that attack in the name of vengeance against the Crusades.
Yes, you're exactly right. In fact, the notice sent to the Spanish media said this is vengeance against Spain, the Crusader. These hurts we inflict on each other somehow go into this terrible, painful groundwater of hurt and resentment that lasts.
So help me to sort this out. There's a bit of confusion about how could we have this flourishing Muslim civilization based on tolerance and mutual respect at the same time that the Crusades are going on?
Yes. When the Crusades start, really the civilization starts to become embattled, on both sides. And the religious rhetoric really ratchets up. So the time that we would most associate with benign Muslim rule would really be up until about the year 1000 is when some of that takes place. Now, then the crusade began on the Christian side. We have two or three major jihads from North Africa during the next couple of hundred years to help their embattled Muslim co-religionists. And there are times during that period when Muslim Spain is really ruled from North Africa. We look at a map and we think of Europe and Africa as being totally distinct. But for historical, accident or the turn of historical events, it might have been otherwise. So really, from the time the Crusades begin on both sides, the religious rhetoric heightens. But having said that, you still have, this marvel that in many of these towns, Muslims, Christians, and Jews learn to, we're going to have to deal with each other. We're here together. We only have one mill for grinding grain, and so they figure out how to share it. Or we only have one bathhouse, and so they figure out how to share it. And I think in a way, they give us a beautiful testament, these ordinary folks, of how humans, sometimes despite every inducement to hate, manage to find ways to accommodate and get along with each other.
One oven for baking bread?
Yes, and think about it. Of course, nowadays we wouldn't think about it, but let's just imagine the medieval era. Of course, wood was the only fuel, and think of how hot you would have to make something in order to bake a loaf of bread, and maybe you'd need one for in a day, and you'd live in a tiny one-room dwelling. So, of course, the idea that people would have their own oven the way we do is inconceivable. So there would be one oven for a town, and someone's job would be to tend the oven. And so Muslims, Christians, and Jews, for better or worse, would just have to learn to, bring their loaves and watch their loaves rise peacefully one next to the other.
You also write in Vanished World about how water was shared among farmers.
Yeah, I think water, I think is a beautiful image for, in this town. The south of Spain, for those who visited, know it's very dry. And one of the great contributions of the Islamic civilization, of course, coming from so many dry lands in the Middle East and Africa and so long, was bringing all kinds of great irrigation technology to southern Spain. And a lot of things that we associate with that area, citrus fruits, rice, cotton, all of these fruits and things came through Islamic civilization. So we have these elaborate canal networks begin. And, of course, farmers have to learn how to share them. And so there also is from Islamic civilization this idea of the water council, that once a week we're all going to meet together and try to iron out any disputes about whether the water is being shared fairly.
And who was in charge of such meetings?
Well, to some extent, they would be, of course, there would be like a town council would sort of oversee them. But I think as historians look at them, one of the, edifying great pieces about these water councils is largely self-governing. The farmers show up. I, the Muslim farmer, and you, the Christian, we're going to stand together in the town square and, with some guidance, we among ourselves are going to sort out what's a fair use of or distribution of water.
We have you waiting to join us from Milwaukee and open lines for anyone else. We're talking about the West's first multicultural, multi-religious society under Muslim rule, Moorish rule in multicultural Spain. My guest is Chris Lowney, who has written about it in a beautiful book called A Vanished World. 1-800-642-1234. Hugh, thank you for joining. Go ahead.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Of course, it wasn't the first time that there was such a multicultural society. Ancient Rome, at first, Christians were a minority. But as they grow, and there are times of persecution that we've all heard of, but there were times when some of the pagan emperors were willing to have one more god, have Jesus as a god, too, among the others. But this was, in a sense, the pagans were offering a kind of tolerance, mm-hmm. but the Christians rejected it. And once the Christians were in power, long before just Spain, the Roman Empire, they made it very difficult for those who were not Christian. Hypatia, whom I assume you've heard of, the mathematician, the pagan mathematician, of course, was murdered by a Christian mob. The pagan temples were taken over. Even the Olympic Games. Why do we have new Olympic Games? Because the Christians closed the pagan Olympic Games. There was intolerance long before 1492. Charlemagne, when he conquers the Saxons, they have to convert or die. Mm. So it wasn't new. Indeed, there was often intolerance among Christians. The Arian Christians might be persecuted. Those who denied the Trinity and according to the Nicene Creed and others were persecuted, so that some of the minority Christians actually welcomed Muslim rule in Egypt and in North Africa and in the Middle East.
Because they expected to have more tolerance under
Islam, yes. Huh. It was a rarity. But 1492, I think the rarity was that they got along, but they got along usually under Islam. And in 1492, you have the expulsion of the Jews, you have the conquest and expulsion of the Moors, the Moriscos, you have the whole New World. You have the development of, Columbus expedition.
Uh-huh.
Monotheism, and this is a question I raise. Is it more likely to have tolerance under polytheism, under a Hindu system or under the pagan system, than under a monotheist system of any kind where you have one God and therefore one truth and any deviance from it?
I think that's an excellent question.
Yeah, Hugh is of course absolutely right that there are all times of periods in history where there are different people of different beliefs one way or another living together or having to live together. Two thoughts going through my mind as she was talking. First is Rome is the perfect example, of course, as before the emperor converted of a polytheistic kind of society that, in fact, harvested gods for import. All gods were kind of welcome in Rome.
Mm.
And, Isis develops a cult in Rome, and Sybil develops a cult in Rome. And, the caller is quite right that, in a sense, the monotheist has a different dilemma than the polytheist, right? Because if I already worship many gods, then one more is not really a conceptual disaster. It doesn't have to be.
Mm.
The monotheist has a different problem, right? And, one of the things that, I talk about a bit in the book is how the Christian kingdoms, in a way, personified by Rome being the first, really deal with what you might call the monotheist problem in a different way than the Muslim kingdoms do. The other quick point I might want to make is, one of the things that makes Spain unique, though, is, very large populations of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Not 90% of one tolerating small groups of the other, but large population of Muslim, large population of Christian. Jews would have always been, of course, less than 10% of the country, but many historians believe there were probably as many Jews in Spain as in the rest of Europe combined.
But the question still remains, given the fact that Muslims are monotheists, what is it that made Muslims more likely to be tolerant of other religious traditions? Because they were people of the book? Does that assume that they would be less tolerant of polytheists?
Yes, it would actually. Of course, Muhammad is born when Christianity and Judaism are existing religions. So in a way, very consciously, the Islamic faith, the other traditions are there. And I can't speak well for Islam, but as I understand it, Islam would understand Christians and Jews, of course, as worshiping the same God of Abraham as Muslims do, but that the revelation within Christian and Judaic scripture was somehow corrupted by the followers and set down in properly. So the vision of Islam would be these are people of the book. They're following a revealed faith as we are, and therefore entitled to a certain degree of tolerance. And those who were not monotheists would not generally be entitled to the same treatment when Islamic civilization conquered one of their territories.
We began the hour by a reference to the new pope, who was very quick to assert that people only get to salvation through Jesus Christ. There's only one truth, and we must adhere to it. And that raised a lot of shivers among people who are concerned about the importance of interfaith dialogue and respect for other religious traditions and so forth in our age of globalization. So it was very reassuring to know that the very first thing he did was to reach out to Muslims. But I'm very grateful to Hugh for pointing out that tendency in monotheistic religions to claim a monopoly on the truth, and how dangerous that is in our own time, when religious strife can lead to annihilation. And as a matter of fact, when some people actually welcome it, are looking forward to a clash, an ultimate clash of civilizations.
Yeah, you know, your point about modern civilization technology is absolutely right. And, you know, what I like to say is, you know, we've turned our globe into medieval Spain. In other words, these folks used to rub shoulders in these tiny villages. Today, media technology delivers us every day the ideas and opinions of those of different beliefs, and military technology empowers us to inflict incredible harm on those whose ideas we may not like. So in a way, technology has turned our globe into one of these little villages where, in a metaphorical sense, we're rubbing shoulders every day. And so we're going to have to figure out what do we need to do in order to make a peaceable, constructive way through this dilemma that we have.
And, you know, in modern Spain, you see all kinds of signs of the reconquest. For instance, in that great mosque in Cordoba, it's been turned into a church, a Christian church, and the Pope will not allow Muslims to worship there. And you can see, you mentioned St. James being turned into the Moor killer. Mm. There are churches where you can see heads, Moorish heads, black heads on the turrets of the churches. And even in the all-pervasive jamón, you know, the ham, the delicious hams of Spain that are hung in all these wonderful delicatessens. That is one of the tangible signs of the reconquest, because pork was forbidden to both Jews and Muslims. So what do we do? What is our present dilemma? And how can our revisiting of this golden age in Spain that ended in 1492 benefit us? Are we condemned to simply repeat history? Can history only be cyclic? Or is there a way out through the spiral, perhaps? We're talking to Chris Launey, who is the author of A Vanished World, Medieval Spain's Golden Age of Enlightenment. I'm Jean Ferraca. You're listening to Here on Earth. You can join us by calling 1-800-642-1234. Do you see parallels in our own time of the loss of the central virtue of tolerance and a reconquest of Christian orthodoxy that threatens those precious values of tolerance and mutual respect and mutual intercourse among all different religious traditions and philosophical traditions? 1-800-642-1234.
The The Ideas Network offers talk radio with a difference. Since there are more than two sides to today's important issues, we look for guests from many different perspectives. Our hosts ask challenging questions of guests, no matter what their political view, and we welcome questions and comments from listeners like you. We bring people and ideas together on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When you travel outside Wisconsin, you can take Wisconsin Public Radio with you. Wherever you go, just log on to WPR.org and click on the button at the top of the homepage. Listen to WPR online.
On the next Here on Earth, we'll talk with the Rosa Parks of Islam. An American journalist, a former Wall Street correspondent who went on pilgrimage to Mecca with her infant son and was radicalized by what she discovered there and came back to stand up to her local imam in West Virginia. She's a very courageous woman. We'll meet her next hour. This hour, we're talking with Chris Lowney about the golden age of Spain, when Muslim rule allowed for the flourishing of a multicultural, multi-religious society that brought into flowering the gifts of all three faiths. And we've been asking questions about whether there are parallels in our own time. We have a clip of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and his appearance last week on conservative Christian telecast, blasting Democrats for their judicial filibusters. Let's listen.
Tell them to do what's right. Tell them to do what's fair. Tell them to do their job. Give judicial nominees the up or down votes they deserve.
Frist delivered a six-minute videotaped message during the broadcast organized by the Family Research Council. The program accused Democrats of filibustering people of faith. It's just the most recent, perhaps, example in a long chain of attempts on the part of the Christian political right to take control of our government's policies in the name of religious fundamentalism. And there's yet another instance of it. It appears in the new issue of Harper's Magazine. Chris Hedges reports from the annual convention of the National Religious Broadcasters, where homosexuals and Arabs are roundly condemned. And in the name of the political theology of dominionism, he talks about the belief that since God in Genesis gave man dominion over the earth, true Christians have been given a divine mandate to take dominion over the United States and purge liberals and secularists from all positions of power. Are we, in fact, in the light of these developments and this turn to the right in our own political and religious dialogue, living through a vanishing world, a world where tolerance was enshrined in our own political traditions? Chris Lowney, how do you respond?
You know, I'm thinking as you're, especially as you, we heard that clip from Senator Frist, that, you know, our debate is just getting so increasingly polarized, left and right, among different religion groups and so on. And, I mean, here's one lesson learned that I think we can take away from medieval Spain. We show up today in these television studios, black and white, I'm right, you're wrong, there's no middle ground. One of the great medieval Spanish philosophers, Averroes, gets in a lot of trouble because he's really taking ideas from Greek philosophers and trying to understand his sacred beliefs through that prism. And he comes under fire for that. And one of the things he says, I think, is instructive for us in some of our predicaments. He says, you know, we avail ourselves of what our predecessors may have said. That they were or were not our co-religionists is of no account. Whatever accords with the truth, we shall happily and gratefully accept. And now, at the end of the quote. So I think this idea of sort of loving the truth above our own ego or above our own party or you know, above our own predisposition on an issue, you know, is a really important lesson from these medieval thinkers to us, and it's one that we've sort of set aside, you know.
We have John joining us from Madison, and an open line left for anyone else who wants to join the conversation. It's 1-800-642-1234. How important is religious tolerance to you? And has it really been an enshrined value in our own society? How important is it to the future of democracy in our civilization? John, thank you for your call. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering when you dated the end of this golden age in Spain, because my understanding is that the Almohad and Almoravid dynasties around the turn of the 13th century pretty well spelled the end of it. I know Maimonides fled about this time, the Jewish prodigy, and went to Egypt to become the famous physician, but it became progressively hard with these fundamentalist-type Maghreb Islamic dynasties, which were not as tolerant. And I know after this period of time that it became progressively more and more difficult to be a Jew. Specifically, it went from being a member of a religion that was not the majority religion to the racial characteristics of the limpieza de sangre, the blood, not blood libel, but the blood accusation, the racial accusation was hurled against the Jews. And I know, you know, from about at least 1300 up to 1500 or 1492 when they were expelled, that it was very, they didn't even trust the people that had converted. And way before 1492 in Thomas de Torquemada, they said that you better convert if you wanted to go anyplace in the culture, because the backdrop of everything that was happening in Spain has to be looked at it as what was being happening in Christendom. The Crusades led to the persecution of the Jews. Innocent III put definite prohibitions against them. The Jews were blamed, just like the pogroms in the Pale of Settlement later on, for everything that happened, including the Black Death of 1346. You know, it goes on and on and on and on. So what are your delineations for this golden age in Spain?
Yeah. Let me make a brief comment on that. And maybe, you know, since John raised it, it'd be worthwhile to spend a minute or two on the story of the Jews, in fact, in the end of this period. First of all, you know, I don't try to make a strict delineation in terms of this was a golden age and it ended in this year, because as John very rightly points out, really almost all during this time, there are moments that were anything but golden, you know, and I try throughout the work, I mean, we only have an hour to talk, I try throughout the work never to oversimplify the fact that, you know, each of these three groups would have always preferred a homogeneous society of their own. There were abuses almost always in many periods. So the goldenness is not that everything went well to me, but what they managed to achieve throughout this time, despite incredible conceptual obstacles. And maybe to spend a moment or two on the story of the Jews, because I think that's very important in this whole story. Spain had always been the place that where those who were getting shunted from elsewhere in Europe, these Jews looked to Spain as the place to come. Jews are kicked out of England in 1290, France in 1306. Spain is always the place that people think to go to. From 1391, there are riots in Spain, pogroms against the Jews, and really from that point, the Jews come under tremendous pressure to convert. And as John alluded to, we come up with a large group of Jews who had converted to Christianity, and many of them, of course, you know, try to do what they can to hold on to their precious faith. Ferdinand and Isabella come along, and in 1481, the Inquisition begins, and the target of the Inquisition comes from a movement within their court that, you know, we have these kind of false Christians, these converts and descendants of converts, and they're really tearing down our church from within. And so the Inquisition is to try and ferret out these so-called false converts. And that gives way in 1492 to the edict to expel the Jews entirely. And by then, the feeling rises among the court, you know, look, part of the problem here is that those who are still remaining true to the Jewish faith are trying to lure, in the words of the expulsion document, are trying to lure faithful Christians back to Judaism. No evidence of that, in fact. And so the solution now becomes, okay, the Jews have 4 months. By the time the decree is promulgated, 3 months to convert or depart Spain forever. Just imagine if you were put in that situation today. Mm. Not merely 3 months to make up your mind, 3 months to pack up your life and be gone.
And so in light of that history, talk about the significance of Pope John Paul II's trip to the Holy Land, his standing at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, his decree that anti-Semitism must end, and so forth. And then Benedict's picking up on that spirit and making gestures towards Muslims.
Yeah, as a Christian, as a Catholic, I take great hope from the fact that, as we approach the year 2000, the millennium, this great symbolic situation of Christian culture, if you will, you know, since we're dating from the birth of the traditional birth date of Christ, what John Paul II says is, look, one of the things we have to do is begin to come to grips with our history, which includes intolerance, which includes horrific use of force unjustly and inappropriately and in ways that has attacked the dignity of others. And as part of the run-up, if you will, to that celebration, quote-unquote, the Pope asks for historians to rethink frankly examine the Inquisition and what went on. And he undertakes these acts, as you mentioned, Gene himself, to begin to try and extend a wish for dialogue, but also express remorse and regret for some of what is Christianity's history in dialogue with other faiths. And as you say, Pope Benedict XVI has at least sent out this early signal, to use his words, that we want to build a bridge of friendship with Islam. And, I consider that a really important statement, and let's see how we what we do with that.
Barry joins in from Madison next. Hi, Barry, go ahead.
Hi. I was curious what the what your guests found in terms of the mystics of the time, or the people who were more universal in their religious outlook. It seems like all religions, sort of divide into those who are literalists, faith in the word, and those who are more experiential, faith in the experience. And the people of experience, mystics, tend to find that other belief systems are more in common with their own and are much more tolerant. I think that's reflected today. And I wonder what he found it was reflected in the time of those people. Where, for example, the Masons or the secret societies where Jews and Muslims and Christians met together in secret. You know, was that more of just an exercise of toleration, or was it more of an expression of our religions really do express a lot of right. similarities and our common truth?
Yeah, I think it's Barry. I thank Barry for raising that question, because that's another great and important strand to our story here, that Spain, medieval Spain, enjoys this incredible flowering of mysticism within the different faith groups. The Kabbalah that we today think of as very modern, we associate with Madonna. The most famous work of the Kabbalah comes from Moses de Leon, a medieval Jew. And the gentleman that's revered as Sufism's greatest master, Ibn Arabi, also a medieval Spaniard. So there's this flourishing of mysticism, and the caller is quite right. You know, these mystics in some way are saying, these rational, logical categories we use are not sufficient to capture, they're too limiting to capture the notion of what God is and what God means to us. And how about this beautiful passage I just found while the question was being asked from Ibn Arabi, that where he talks about religions and distinctions between them, or distinctions that there shouldn't be. I'm quoting now. "My heart has become capable of every form. It is a pasture for gazelles and a convent for Christian monks, and a temple for idols and the pilgrim's Kaaba and the tables of the Torah and the book of the Quran. I follow the religion of love." As you might imagine, that would have been a shocking concept to traditional believers in any of the faith groups then, but what a powerful image he gives us.
John is next in Eau Claire. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just had a comment in regard to your what you were saying earlier about monotheism, in some sense, kind of implying a lack of tolerance in those who hold monotheism. Just kind of wanted to nuance the definition of Christianity a little bit. Definitely a monotheistic religion, but a little different in the sense that holds the theological doctrine of the Trinity. So kind of embracing the idea of unity within diversity, and how I, as a Christian, I feel like that, in some sense, gives hope.
Sort of to, like, e pluribus unum.
Yeah. Gives hope to tolerance. I feel like a lot of, I also just want to say that I think you mentioned dominion theology. Just Christians across the country, there's a lot more diversity than just, even within evangelical circles, than maybe what Bill Frist is representing.
Okay, good. Let's get a response from Chris before we run out of time.
Yes, well, thank you for the listener. Absolutely. I mean, there's great diversity in Christianity, and most I know want to build a better world where we can share, where we can all discover this shared pool of values and join in worship of the same God.
Chris, thank you so much for being with us. Chris Lowney is the author of A Vanished World, Medieval Spain's Golden Age of Enlightenment. He's also the author of Heroic Leadership, Best Practices from a 450-Year-Old Company That Changed the World. And that's about the Jesuits. He's a former Jesuit. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of this program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 501J. Visit our website, www.hereonearth.org, and if you look under Archives, you'll find links to Chris Lowney and his book, A Vanished World. Plus, you can post your thoughts online at our web forum. Here on Earth broadcasts live weekend afternoons from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, and then you can catch the repeat Monday through Thursday night at 8, or listen to past shows anytime on our archive, on our online archive. Here on Earth is produced by Carmen Jackson, Joe Hartke, Lisa Boo, Bill Kirkpatrick, Heather Stir, and myself, in cooperation with the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Jean Faraca.